Live from Gloucester, Massachusetts, podcasting around the world.
Around the world.
You're listening to the GloucesterCast Podcast, a production of Joey Shimataro and Good Morning Gloucester Media. Kick back, relax, and enjoy the show with your host, Joey Shimataro, and his crew of merry castaways. No piping plovers will be intentionally harmed in the production of this podcast.
Good morning, Gloucester. We are here at the Cape Ann, no, not the Cape Ann Museum.
No, we are not.
We are at Maritime Gloucester, of all places. I'm joined by Catherine Ryan.
Good morning.
Good morning. Michael Cascio.
Hey.
And Phil Grabsky, who are the co-directors and producers of American Masters, Hopper, an American Love Story, which is going to be on PBS on January 2nd. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, it's great to have you guys here. I really appreciate you joining us this morning. Catherine has done extensive research on Edward Hopper, and the Cape Ann Museum just finished. Are they all done with that?
Yeah,
so they're all done with, they just had a tremendous run, probably the biggest run of that museum's illustrious, history as, this summer. The amount of people that came into town to see that show was completely over the top, and rightfully so. Mm-hmm. Catherine, you have a bunch of questions.
I do.
Why don't we hop right into it? Because I know you guys are on a tight time schedule.
Hop right into it. So I really admired this documentary, and I thought it was such a good match because you have worked together before, and you've done so many documentaries on artists and musicians, and it also was a collaboration, and you're covering this collaborative art partnership. So I wanted you to talk about that, if that was on your mind, working as a pair, talking about Edward Hopper and Joe Hopper.
Yeah, I mean, first, just get back to the Cape Ann Museum. It's been basically a year of Hopper, with the Whitney exhibition, in New York, and this exhibition. And for me, and probably for Phil, it reinforces our belief that Hopper is the rare American artist who is both widely popular and critically acclaimed at the same time. And obviously Hopper's work touches a nerve in the American public, and we can get into that, but it's a great time to look into Hopper's life, and we discovered a lot of different things. But the most important part was the art, and that's what got me interested, and probably Phil as well, knowing Phil.
And interestingly, the first exhibition I saw as part of this project, and hello, everybody, by the way, the first exhibition that I saw as part of this project was in Nyack at the Hopper House, which is a fantastic, it's a wonderful place where obviously Hopper was born and lived. But when I went there by chance, actually it wasn't quite by chance, but I was fortunate that they had an exhibition of Joe Niverson Hopper's work.
Yes, the watercolor.
And that was very important. One, because I met the curator as well as the director or the CEO of Hopper House. But two, just to see her work in an exhibition, which hadn't happened very often. Since she met Edward Hopper really in Gloucester, and she basically decided that she would put her own career on a back burner and promote his. One of the great revelations of the film, of course, is you can't understand him without understanding her, and that all begins or is cemented in Gloucester. To go back to your question, often directors work alone in terms of, you know, as the director, but always as part of a team. It's always a creative, collaborative process with your editors, your camera people, whoever it might be. I haven't co-directed very many films, and this was a fantastic example of where it worked really well. I've known Michael a long time, and we have worked together in slightly different capacities in the past. And really, it was something of a accidental meeting of minds a few years ago when, to cut a long story short, we were chatting and both realized that we had a similar ambition to make a film about Edward Hopper. And in fact, we'd both started doing our research. And what we didn't know is we had a mutual friend who had just himself made a short about Edward Hopper, or one specific element of Edward Hopper's life. So all these kind of serendipitous things were happening, and it worked tremendously well, I have to say. I mean, I'm obviously based in Britain. I came across to America 4 or 5 times, but we're even with the pandemic, which obviously got in our way a little bit, I'm tremendously happy with the results. Because as Michael said, he's one of those artists that I think most people would recognize his images. Yeah. I would imagine that Nighthawks could be considered one of the top American artworks of the 20th century. But people don't tend to know, some people don't know who painted it.
Yeah.
And some people, or a lot of people, won't know very much about him or have a very singular idea of who he is, which is often not the case. And certainly he's more complex and more multifaceted than many people would think.
Yeah, and the story of how Joe essentially marketed his work begin in Gloucester is an essential part of the story. And just to piggyback on something Phil just said, the film is done, you know, for American Masters on PBS, and that is a biographically inclined series that specifically looks at the person and his or her relationship to what they do and how that came about. So when I realized that American Masters had not done anything on Hopper, which was a big surprise because they've done Wyeth and Rothko and others, that's when I got to them and said, how do you want to do that? And I might be able to get this other guy, Phil, involved. And then, you know, it all came to fruition, which we can go into ad nauseum detail. But happy to be here. So thank you for your interest.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You know, you say thank you very much for allowing me to have access to the screening, for the media screening. And it's interesting, the title to me, Hopper, an American Love Story, and some of the images of the sketches of Hopper, emaciated, and because we learned that Joe really does not like to cook that much, and then and some of the other images, it was just interesting. How did the title Hopper, an American Love Story, where does that come in?
Well, I think titles are clip. You know, when people are looking through their TV guides, you might have a fraction of a second to get somebody's attention. And it was very important for us, first of all, that people realized this was a film about Edward Hopper and not Dennis Hopper. But also, I think that having that kind of secondary part to the title is important, you know, to give you a sense of what the film, you know, the angle of the film, the approach of the film. And it's deliberately ambivalent. On the one hand, what's so interesting about Hopper is that he has this fantastic love for America. He's living at a time when American artists are now looking at the United States, at North America. It's only a few decades earlier when, you know, their incentive, which Hopper does briefly as a young man, but their incentive is to go to Rome and paint the Colosseum, to go to Venice and paint the canals, to go to Paris and be alongside Monet and Giverny. now American artists are saying, well, what is American? And this is a moment when you start to see artists painting hay barns in the middle of a field. Or, you know, yes, they've been painting landscapes for a while, but now starting to paint things which might have previously felt to be rather mundane. So with Hopper, he's painting shop fronts or the corner of a shop or the outside of a diner. For him, this is something that is fascinating his entire life. So he has this love for America. But it's also, I think, very important that people understand that it has a secondary meaning, just as important, which is it is a love story between the two of them. Now, for those who do know something about Edward Hopper, there tends to be a misunderstanding that, and this is the impression that I was given when I started researching this film. This was a man who was monosyllabic. He never gave interviews. He didn't talk to people. He kept to himself. He was unpleasant to the point of abusive towards his wife, who very little was known about. Humorless. And actually, while there's an element of truth in all of that, he's much more complex. And that relationship, albeit difficult, and that's reflected in the film, this is a couple that, to the best of our knowledge, Michael and myself, they woke up in the same bed every year for decades. They went on these long 2-month car journeys together. We all know what kind of pressures that puts on a couple. not that I'm saying anything about it.
Just to stop for a second, there is that interview, there are two interviews in the film which you saw with people who actually met the Hoppers. Hoppers didn't have any kids, so it's kind of hard to find people around, and they met him, but their experiences were fundamentally unpleasant. So, this is what great art is necessary. Your personality isn't necessarily reflective of the work.
But part of that with him, and it's true of so many great artists, is that what motivates a great artist is never or rarely fame and fortune. It is the desire to be as good as you can possibly be in your chosen métier. Mm. Mozart didn't want to be famous and rich, although he would have taken both. He wanted to be respected by fellow musicians and fellow composers. And that's common. Hopper, he just wants to paint. He just wants to improve. He just wants to constantly push the boundaries of what he's comfortable doing. And all the kind of acclaim that came in New York and, you know, the going to the parties and getting the awards, that really didn't interest him very much. And that meant that at times when he would go to social events, he's the kind of person sitting in the corner not saying very much. That is a bit, that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, and Joe picked up the thread, though. Joe was the absolute opposite. Complete opposite. She was a dancer. She was an actress. She was animated, and she was able to do what he couldn't do. He could not sell his own work. I don't know if it's because he was unpleasant or just because he was so focused on his work. And so she did the ultimate sacrifice, which is a story of modern day, of the the wife giving up her own very promising career to promote his, which is I think an extraordinary story that is relatable in this day and age.
But you have to look, but absolutely true. But you also have to look at the evidence. So there was a Whitney exhibition that opened that you mentioned right at the beginning, and Hopper's New York. And there was this fantastic bequest that formed the backbone of that exhibition from a guy called Sanborn, who basically, this family had looked after all the stuff that would otherwise have been thrown away. Front pages of magazines, but included in that were all the cinema tickets. Now, this couple would go to the cinema frequently, and they'd keep their tickets, which were multicolored. So you see them torn in half, and they'd write on them what they'd seen. There was a wonderful framing of these in the exhibition, and it's very, very beautiful because there's all these different kinds of tickets. The point being, they might have had an argument in the morning, but they went to the cinema together. When they're doing certain paintings, they go location scouting together. She is his model in virtually every single painting that he does. It's her. partly because it's easier and cheaper, and partly because she didn't want any other women to be his models. But still, this couple have this remarkable relationship. And the point of all this is, as Michael says, you cannot understand the paintings, which are iconic, many of them, particularly the ones of New York, although there's plenty in the film that people won't have seen before. You can't understand the paintings without understanding his biography, and you can't understand his biography without understanding their relationship.
Well, we also see
documentary.
You know, they clearly painted side by side in Gloucester. You have the St. Anne's steeple with the railroad tracks there, where if you're from Gloucester, you would immediately recognize the location. And there, and you have her painting and his painting, and you see the different styles.
It is pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's visual proof, of
Gloucester, her. As Michael said at the beginning, Gloucester is tremendously important. And I loved my two trips to Gloucester. And I think it's true, whenever you make a biography, you have to visit the locations.
Definitely.
And, you know, she was the more successful artist when they meet in Gloucester. They had met in New York. In fact, they've been to the same art school together, but they kind of start to form a relationship in Gloucester. And she teaches him, particularly watercolors. But then what's interesting about him and reflective of his character, and again, this is mentioned in the film, while other artists, and Gloucester was, I'm sure you know, and your community, your audience knows, was it so attractive to artists. There were so many artists would come and paint. But they go down to the seafront and they paint ships and boats and sailors and fishermen. What Hopper does is he wanders around and he starts drawing and painting things that other people aren't that interested in, the front of the buildings.
Right.
And of course, what's so great in Gloucester, and the film has these dissolves, but these buildings are still there.
Yeah.
So you can work out, and I was very lucky, we were very lucky, because the director of the Cape Ann Museum is a fantastic guy, and he gave us a lot of his time to say, this is where he put his easel. So that's where we could put our tripod. And you see exactly what Hopper was seeing, more or less. And then it's fascinating to see the reality and how he then transforms that on a two-dimensional, you know, on a canvas into a painting. And it really kicks off his career. I think, wouldn't you say, Michael, without Gloucester?
You definitely can make the case that without Joe, there wouldn't necessarily be the Edward Hopper. And without Gloucester, there wouldn't have been the two of them. And it was a meeting point for both of their lives. And he was 41 when they got married. So it was kind of later in life. But he hadn't sold a painting in 11 years, right? So
was Mansard Roof the painting?
$100, yeah. They bought it and sold it for $100.
But that is that the one that kicked off? Like, you know, he had that drought where he hadn't sold anything for 10 years, and then Mansard Roof was
Mansard
put
on. Roof was the one
by his good buddy George Bellows, fellow painter. Yeah. So you kick into Gloucester like 14 minutes into the documentary, and the music changes, and it's kind of light piano. And so I was happy about that.
Well, it's when he was probably the most agreeable. You know, it was a love story at that point. You know, they're falling in love, and they quote poetry together, and it's a great moment. It's essential to the story. It's the pivot point for the entire story. And I think that's what the difference is in this particular documentary. I don't know that there have been any other biographical documentaries on Hopper, but certainly Joe's influence and the beginnings of which are in Gloucester are central to the story. For me, the irony is that they sell Mansard Roof, and it's a watercolor, right? So, which is
The blank canvas was earlier, but you have new things that are in this documentary that I haven't seen in other ones. So you have interviews with people that knew him in Cape Cod. We've never seen that. And you have voiceovers with these incredible actors and reading the extant documents. And what was that like? You know, how did you, what was the process going to get the voiceover actors and big ones?
Thanks to two things. One is our friends at PBS who were able to rally people, familiar voices. The other was the actor strike. And they are basically not working at the time we did these readings. And PBS is not under the same guidelines that everybody else is, so they were able to do that, and they just give an extra oomph of drama to the actual diary entries, which I think
was there something that surprised you with that, with working with them, or
well, Christine, you know? Baranski was like the perfect voice.
Really,
I mean, they're all terrific, unbelievable, yeah. But Christine Baranski was Joe personified in terms of the voice. At least that's how, that was my feeling. You felt my feel differently.
No, not at all. What I think is so interesting is that the first thing you do when you're making a biographical film is try to find correspondence, try to find, not to read kind of secondhand accounts, but actually find letters, or if it's a more recent artist, you know, filmed interviews, radio interviews, because then you get their actual voice. And while they might be talking in a certain way to certain people, that's the place to start. So it makes films about Vermeer or Rembrandt or Bosch very difficult because there is no correspondence.
Yeah.
And our fear with Hopper was that we were told, you know, this is a guy who didn't like to put his thoughts down on paper, wasn't interviewed by television. I mean, can you imagine a 20th century great, very, very successful artist,
yeah,
basically not interviewed, refusing everything.
Yeah, it's on the cover of Time magazine. I mean, it wasn't like he was unknown, you know.
Yeah.
Almost a recluse at times. But what you have to do, and, you know, you guys would do the same, is you think, well, okay, that seems to be the opinion, but what's the reality? So you go looking. And then you start to find that when he does speak, when he does write a response to somebody, or when he does write for a newspaper, when he is interviewed on the radio, and the two televised interviews that we did find, actually he's very articulate.
Yeah.
And he really is very thoughtful. And what's great for the film, of course, is he's actually quite funny too.
Yeah.
And then you start to think, okay, so I've got this. What are the pictures telling me? Because obviously that's essential too to understanding the biography. And of course, if you look at the paintings, you start also to see his humour. And he's playing with the audience and he's leaving things. That door has no handle. That diner has no front door. I mean, there's no signs on the windows. What? He's playing with you. And that's very conscious. There's no accidents in Hopper's work. So all these things come together. And so the more you can have their voice, Hopper's voice, the better it is for the film. With Joe, I mean, we're just so fortunate that she just kept these notebooks.
Oh, they're unbelievable. The diaries are...
Mm-hmm. I don't know where she got the time. I mean, they're so detailed about what they ate and how much they spent and how he's behaving. And, you know, sometimes she calls him Eddie if she's getting on with him, and E if she's not. And, but again, if you read through those and you select, quite selective, I guess, again, you start to get a more nuanced understanding of their relationship. And again, there's humor. But there's also, you know, sometimes they're quite plaintive. Sometimes she is aware of the fact that she's abandoned more or less her own career for him, and he's not appreciative enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, you know, we have to say that just because you're a great artist doesn't excuse bad behavior. And there's times when he is very badly behaved, but then she could also give
feedback,
you know. It was tempestuous. But again, we have the advantage of those readings. And if you get a great actor and a great actress to read them in the way that they have in the film, then that obviously adds to the drama of the documentary.
I found the interviews that you include in this documentary to be fascinating, and they just show that he definitely cared about his legacy. You know, he cared. He wasn't so cantankerous that he was aloof.
Very thoughtful. You know, there's there's the black and white interview, which, you know, is the earlier days of public television. But he's very, very thoughtful in that interview. And then the other one, the color one, which we dug up in the NBC archives, which nobody had ever, as far as I know, had done anything of substance with it. He's reflective. It's a few years later, and he's sort of reflecting back on his career, and that's when he shows a little bit of humor. On the other one, he shows a little bit of humor as well. But he is extremely observant about his own career and his own work. As Phil says, there are no accidents. He's very aware of what he's doing and how it affects people. And in some cases, he cares. In some cases, he doesn't care.
Can you speak to this?
There's an interesting point you raised there, which is the extent to which he cared about what people would think about him after he was dead. It's interesting. One of the things that is so fascinating about Hopper, of course, is that he's growing up at the time, you know, the explosion of cinema and then television. But in terms of cinema, his paintings are very cinematic. Mm-hmm. Part of the appeal for us as filmmakers, even the type of landscape paintings that he does, they're full of narrative. They're almost like still frames, aren't they? Something's just happened, you're not sure what, something's going to happen, you have to guess what that might be. But then he starts to influence filmmakers, and filmmakers, Hitchcock's mentioned in the film, but there's plenty of others. The Simpsons have done their own riff on Nighthawks, haven't they?
The noir, yeah.
And he was very aware of that.
Could you put up on Nighthawks, just because, you know, just for viewers, so get a little...
It's an extraordinary painting.
Again,
what's interesting is that this is 1942. This is during the Second World War. Would you know? I mean, he doesn't...
Yeah.
You know, there's no paintings that really show skyscrapers in his paintings of New York. There's nothing that shows the 1929 Depression. It's a very singular view he's having of the world. So then I think he's deliberately playing with you as the audience. You know, you're being asked to try and work out, why are these people there?
And why am I so attracted to it? I mean, I think the popularity of it is not because it represents the 20th century or World War II or the Depression or anything. It's because people bring their own views of that and maybe can relate to the solitary aspect of it or the communal getting to the dawn. Everybody has their own thing.
I mean, throughout my lifetime, if you go to any print shop, you know, like, I remember, right, you remember the Harvard Coupe and Spencer. I mean, like this image throughout I'm only 56, but, you know, has just permeated our society so deeply. And I don't know that there's anyone that wouldn't recognize it.
In our age, it was featured in Masterpiece, you know, Parker Brothers. It's in Ferris Bueller, movie. I mean, it's a touchstone cultural icon.
What we provide you in the film is just a chance to look at it again. So if you look at the background of this painting, you know, the side of the road, that's very abstract. I mean, his work, you know, they're blocks of color. You look at those windows across the way or the sidewalk, this green sidewalk. Again, if you look carefully, where's the entrance? Where's the sign telling you anything about what's going on? There's one door with no handle. I mean, and certain things are reflected in great detail, like the coffee urns. Other things are just almost just blocks of color. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant painting.
Yeah.
So I really admired, I feel like you let the experts that you interviewed that have been involved in all these major Hopper shows, their personalities come through, and they're all seated. I mean, they were almost all like a Hopper subject. And then I also, there's no pattern where you interview someone and then you go to a picture and you show the painting or a close up. Like you don't necessarily reinforce what the interviewer just said to us. but you almost let us sit with it. And I thought it was really, it was mirroring the artist. And I thought did that really beautifully. You let the art speak and the people interpreting it.
Yeah, both Phil and I felt very strongly from day one that the art is the star and that the art tells the story. And we were not going to mess with it, or at least my goal from day one was not to animate it or try to do something funky with it or bring it to, so weird. The artwork itself tells a story and is worth the extra time to kind of soak it in. And as a result, there are 40 or 50 images there that help tell the story. So we're not skimping on it. I felt very strongly that.
But the pacing is so nice. Like you have a compressed amount of time. You cover so much ground in the beginning, and then you kind of linger with the mature work. It's hard to do. I think you really did a great job with that.
I think there's a couple of things there. One, I guess it's any teacher would know this. You almost want the audience to have the questions in their mind before you give them the answers or somebody's answer, because then they're more receptive to it. So rather than just telling them stuff and expecting people to remember, let them look at the painting, start to formulate their own questions. What's going on? When did he paint it? Who's he painting it for? Mm-hmm. And then offer up some questions, some answers. The other thing is that I think it's a mistake that documentary filmmakers make often when they interview people, which is they interview somebody because they want them to say something that fits the pre-written narrative.
Yeah.
Right. And we do that all the time.
I was nervous, right? And it didn't. And I also, you film so many prior things on artists, and you get to go to these incredible museum shows and go up close and film them. And I did notice the way that you film some of the NIAC scenes where Hopper grew up, and then they come in later in the documentary, whether it's a passage of light or a detail of a staircase. And it just was very nice how it went back and forth. But you did help me notice on the portrait he did of her, which I think are very tender. So many of his artworks of her that he gave to her are very tender. But you go in on the necklace in a way that I haven't really, and it made me think about Vermeer, and I know you've done a documentary on Vermeer too. So were there things that you were conscious of or surprised by when you were doing that?
Well, for me, somebody says in the film that he's the master of light.
Yeah.
All artists study the artists that have gone before them. It's something I'm constantly telling young documentary filmmakers when they ask for advice. I'd say, well, watch as many documentaries as you can. Go back to Flaherty and Grierson and all these people, just because it's in black and white, because there's so much to learn. So somebody like, and this is why I didn't know very much about Hopper's trips to Paris, actually.
Yes.
He goes to these galleries and he's learning. And he paints in the style of the Impressionists. He experiments with it. He goes to galleries, he goes to Amsterdam himself, and he looks at the works of Rembrandt. This is typically what a young artist should do, did do. Then he creates his own style and he kind of sticks with it. He's clearly aware of Vermeer, and he's clearly aware for him, the study of light is something that stays with him all his life. What was very interesting for Michael and I is that the first trips that we made to NIAC, we were just lucky. I mean, in my case, I went on a slightly different day to Michael, but on my day, it was a very, very cold day. The previous day in New York, they'd had one of the worst blizzards they'd had in years. But the next day was completely sunny. Mm-hmm. I turned up in NIAC and got into that bedroom.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible to over-romanticize this kind of
thing. No, it's a Hopper painting. Right.
Yeah. It was very effective.
The light that comes into his bedroom is a Hopper painting.
But this is a connection to Vermeer, because with Vermeer, you have to remember that Vermeer is living in the Netherlands, which is a nation of canals. And now those canals are mirrors, and the light is reflected. If you look at his view of Delft, which is one of the greatest paintings ever, in my opinion, half the painting is just the water, which is a mirror of the sky and the light, and it's throwing light onto all the objects around it. Edward Hopper is born in a bedroom, and as he grows up, he's looking out of his window and he's seeing the Hudson. I hadn't realized, not at Nyack, but not that far from Nyack, the Hudson's a mile wide.
Yeah.
A huge mirror of the sky. The day that I happened to go, it was very bright, and that light is coming straight through that window.
Yeah.
He's lying in bed looking at the light traversing his wall. It's must, I mean, okay, we've got to be careful, but one can assume it's plausible. Yeah. But this had an impact on him. Yeah. And so, and we, frankly, we could have done a 52-minute film just on Nyack.
I agree.
The boy that leaves Nyack, you know, he doesn't change so much in his personality beyond that. But as you were saying earlier, you've got 52 minutes to tell a, you know, a long story.
But Nyack, you also go to his Washington Square Park, you know, his lifelong small home, too. And you have the close-up of the easel with all the pinprints. I was very happy to see that.
It's very humbling to go there because it's a smallish apartment, and it overlooks Washington Square. And as one of the interviewees says, you know, there's all sorts of activity going on in Washington Square. It's a hub of urban activity, music and rallies and protests and whatnot. And, of course, none of that shows up in Hopper's work. He's on his own track and... But he lived in this quintessential New York apartment.
And it has to be said that Michael and Cynthia, they did extraordinarily well to get in there. It's not that easy to get in. Yeah. You're lucky it survived. You can imagine there's been lots of people wanting to use it for lots of different things subsequently, but it has survived. But, you know, it's not open to the public. So it was great to get in. And again, we had nice light, you know, a bit of a breeze.
Yeah. Open the windows, windows. But anyway, it was a great Hopper moment.
Do you have more?
Yeah, well, other thing that I wanted to touch on, because I'm not as, you know, knowledgeable, the theme of solitude and the vein through his work of solitude. Could you touch upon that a little bit?
I'm really glad you pointed this out, because I read towards the end of the pandemic, my friend has just caught COVID. COVID hasn't disappeared, but towards the end of the pandemic, there was an article that said that the artist that has been most used to illustrate articles about the pandemic, about COVID, is Hopper. Mm-hmm. And these images of a person alone in an office, alone at home, staring out of a window, and that Hopper is the artist of isolation, the artist of, as you mentioned, solitude. That is true, but one also has to be careful not to present that as being depressive, you know, depressed and lonely. And there's a very good example of this in the film, which is there's a woman sitting seated at a table with a cup of coffee. And traditionally she's been...
Pat has this. She's
going to
post it.
Well, that's chop suey. I think you're also looking at Automat.
No, chop suey. Sorry, it's the one I'm talking about is...
Do you have it? Automat.
I do, but not... We'll pull one up, but you can keep going.
It's a singular woman at a table.
Traditionally, she's talked about as... Because there's a chair opposite her, which is empty. Again, it's a bit like Vermeer. Now, with Vermeer, those chairs did reflect the absent male. You know, the lover who's left, the piano, the music teacher that's coming. But in this case, I think, and one of the interviewees also says the same thing, actually, this is Hopper just reflecting a woman having a bit of time to herself. Just, you know, society's changing. A woman could go out now and just sit on her own and not be misunderstood as to what she was up to. She's just sitting there having a cup of coffee on a busy day, maybe on the way to work, on the way home from work. And again, this is where you have to look quite carefully.
Pat?
There you go. I'm sorry.
That's it.
We'll go right here. That work?
There she is.
And that's why these paintings are worth time. You look at that, you don't see the automats, you don't see the machines that were for a quarter you could get your burger or your piece of apple pie. Look at the window. The window's brilliant. It's just black. With the reflection of the ceiling lights.
The lights, yeah.
You don't see anything through the window. I mean, he only includes what he needs for his story. And his story isn't necessarily what you think. It's not oh, you know, she's been stood up, she's upset, you know, she's lonely because there's a man who has. It's not about the man. It's about her on her own, having some time to herself.
Yeah, I mean, so, the bigger picture of that is that people bring their own interpretation to Hubbard's work in an extraordinary way. He discounts it. He's in the interview, one of the interviews, the rare TV interviews that he gave, he says it's been overblown. Oh, no, it was in one of his writings, I think. Yeah. He says it's the loneliness thing is overdone. He's sort of tongue-in-cheek there, but the point is that it wasn't necessarily his intent the viewer.
But the thing is with him is he was comfortable with his own company. He was comfortable being on his own. And in fact, sometimes that was a problem because he would exclude Jo, wouldn't talk to her for 4 or 5 days. But he didn't feel the need to be surrounded by people and to be communicating with people. And so being on his own to him didn't equate to being lonely.
Yeah.
Did you want that?
Yes. So this is, can you speak to this one right here? Can you
get up? It's so blue.
Yeah. The one where he portrays himself as the clown a little bit. Yeah. Right there. And just, yeah.
Well, that's a very important painting because he comes back from Paris. And that is reflective of Paris. It's, without going into too much detail now, it is where he is in his artistic development. So he's learned from the Impressionists and he's experimenting with that. He's also having this, which the film talks about, this previously not really known 10-year affair, well, we say affair, relationship with somebody called Alta Hillsdale that wasn't known about. Probably not, the relationship wasn't returned by her, really. So there's some personal angst in that painting.
So, and I mean, she tells him that she's going to get married, which is a total shock to him after 10 years of pursuing her. This painting and one other, I think, reflects his bitterness or his view of the very difficult circumstance.
But he put everything into this painting. So all he'd learned previous to this and all he'd learned in his 3 trips in Paris, all he'd learned from going to those galleries and looking at Rembrandt and Manet, and he puts into this painting and he brings it out, he releases it in New York and people are like, what is this?
It looks so contemporary.
Well, and then it went into storage. I think, Catherine, you can relate to this. The Whitney found it rolled up somewhere, wasn't part of their...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
This is how art history works. So Picasso does the same thing. He paints Les Demoiselles d'Avignon when he's about 28 years old, which is the culmination of everything he's learned. And people are shocked. And he rolls it up too and puts it away for 10 years. And it's only when MoMA buys it and makes it like a centerpiece. And it's been on their walls ever since they bought it in 1948 or something. I'm not quite sure. But people's tastes change. But for Hopper, this was had that painting been well received, he'd have gone off in a certain direction.
Right.
Then he has to regroup. And he becomes, he starts doing kind of etchings and magazine covers and then the relationship with that's why he's open to learning from Jo and watercolors and he ends up doing these oil paintings. Once he finds oil paintings, he sticks with that at least 6 months of the year. In New York, it's the oil paintings. You know, when he's in Cape Cod, then he has, he's doing slightly different things, which are very interesting, actually. I didn't know so much about those.
What's so interesting to me is, he's the illustrator, and, he's a very good illustrator. But from what I could gather, he was really not, happy being an illustrator because he's doing work for other people. Like they're, interpreting their what they want him to interpret. Yeah. I can relate to that as a... I don't want to make this about me at all, but like as for the blog, when someone tasks me to cover a story, I have much less interest in it than when it's my idea to cover that same story. I don't know what that is,
you're an artist. Yeah,
he was an absolutely brilliant illustrator. Again, you just stop and look a little bit, and there were plenty more in that Whitney exhibition, and. I mean, he was extraordinarily talented. But again, he's being told, right, this week you've got to do these four illustrations.
Right.
Do what you're told. You're advertising toothpaste or whatever it might be.
And this is before he met Joe.
Yeah.
Any artist is going to start to resent that after a while, I think.
Yeah.
But he does it for years. I mean, you know, it's not a flash in the pan. He's doing it for a long time.
Right. Yeah. Well, anything else for you, Catherine?
Well, back to film stuff.
What's that?
Back to film question.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, I just, like, was there something that you had to leave on the cutting room floor that you were like, oh, my God, I wish I put it in? Or?
So much material that you couldn't include. I think, you know, for me, it was the diaries and the interviews mm-hmm. with Hopper because they're first person mm-hmm. accounts. And we did a lot of it, you know, so it wasn't like we didn't do it, but you could build an even bigger and more even it just hints at the drama that is there. That's for me. There are plenty of other things that weren't able to include, but that's normal for any documentary. I mean, that's, you know, you gather material way more than you need and you whittle it down to the essence.
You could probably build a mini series based off of those.
No, it's very true.
And it would probably be, you know, probably be very sellable, you know. But yeah, we really appreciate your time today, guys. Mm-hmm. And I'm
congratulations.
And I feel so fortunate to have seen the screening, the media's pre-screening, and I know that people are going to be so excited and so happy to see the wonderful work that you guys put together. You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, what's the labor of love a factor on a project like this for you guys?
11.
11 and a half.
I can imagine. So January 2nd on PBS.
Very good. Everyone's fed up. You know, they've eaten too much. They really can't talk anymore.
It is a perfect night for that.
So we're going to sit at home and watch a great film. I think
it really is.
Watch someone else's Family Dynamics.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's a good point.
Very well put.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. We have a link right there that Pat put. We have On Point Pat, our producer behind the scenes here, that she's been putting these links up for us. So if you're watching this on Facebook or YouTube or Twitch or Instagram, those links are clickable and you can learn more about this project. And again, I can't thank you enough for coming on for us.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
And the art galleries in Gloucester, please, anyone that's local to you must visit them. They are fantastic. Yeah. And they've got, you know, so many wonderful artworks.
Here's a little story about that. So the blog is 16 years old, Good Morning Gloucester. And every middle schooler in Gloucester goes through Cape Ann Museum. And then a lot of people just, that's your extent. So the last time I had gone through, before I got involved with the blog and everything, the last time I had gone through Cape Ann Museum when I was like 9 years old, I'm 56 now. So like you can imagine, like, so now the blog starts and, you know, that's such a part of the community. I go in and I'm completely blown away that what we have in our backyard. I mean, it's not just Hopper. I mean, it is Henry Lane. And I mean, it's just a marvel that we have this in our backyard, and they've done such a great job with it. Yeah, so we know, but there's a lot of people, a lot of townies and stuff like that, that if they, you know, I beg them on a probably semi-annual basis, you have to go, because it is amazing inside there. I know, so thanks for saying that as well.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. Thank you.
All right, well, listen, have a great day, guys. Thanks again, and looking forward to January 2nd.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Good morning.
All right. We'll see you guys.
Take care.
Great.